Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Empowering Family Caregivers Show on We're very happy to have you all join us. We have a special guest today. Her name is Melissa Kahn, and pardon me, and I think we have some issues with sound back here. Just bear with me. I'm hearing myself live, so once again, let me go ahead and introduce Melissa Kahn. Melissa joins us from Kahn Healthcare Consulting. She was clinically trained at New York University and started off her career in terminal care, where she worked with people who had AIDS, cancer, and end-stage renal disease before she moved to Chicago 20 years ago. And during that time, she designed programs and services for a variety of organizations such as Horizon Hospice and St. Joseph Hospital, Formations in Healthcare, a variety of organizations, including, I see here, a CVS Pharmacy. Melissa started her own consulting firm, which is Kahn Healthcare Consulting, LLC, in 2006 and works with organizations and families to help them better prepare for aging and by developing trainings and workshops and in-services. She has also served on the advisory boards for Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Cognitive Neurology and Alzheimer's Disease Center, Chicago, and LA Caregivers Magazines. Melissa wrote and also self-published The Personal Healthcare Passport, which we'll talk about a little later. It's a practical tool which originally was designed by her 16 years prior to help her mother, who was diagnosed with lung cancer and emphysema. Melissa, thank you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you to all your listeners.
So, Melissa, why don't you tell us about your experience as a caregiver to your parents and, you know, how that might have influenced what you do now.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I tell people that things I'm most proud of is probably being a caregiver for my parents. Caring for both of them who are now deceased was really a privilege and an honor. And while I'm grateful for the opportunity and I wanted to make sure that they had dignity and respect not only while they were living but at the end of life, I think I used my early years from training to really help guide me. And while there are times where it wasn't always easy, especially because I was doing this long distance, it was something that as a family we had a plan and we had talked about. So we were really well prepared. And from my early work, as I said, I was really well aware of what others would deal with when they were diagnosed with a terminal disease. And when my mother was diagnosed with cancer and then with emphysema and cancer, I knew that it may not be easy for her to talk about how she was dealing with it. So I wanted her to have something to really chronicle the disease and also as a way for her to manage everything. I gave her, at the time, was a journal, but it became her lifeline because she used it to chronicle side effects, to document all the changes that were going on physiologically, appointments, everything with medication management. And it became such a lifeline that she carried it with her every day of her life, the last year of her life. And when she died, people asked me, where can I find something like this? And almost 20 years ago, there wasn't anything out there. So what I decided to do was to take what I had created for my mother and modify it in a simplified version so that families could have something practical to use to manage disease process, to feel empowered, especially at a time when they oftentimes don't feel like they're very powerful. So it really became a labor of love for me, and it was really inspired by my mom.
That's a terrific story. And, you know, so many of us out there are long-distance caregivers, so I'm assuming this is very practical for long-distance caregivers as well as caregivers who are right there on the ground with their families.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a tool that really can help people not only chronicle everything, but it's a way to really enhance communication with family members. I've written it in a style so that family members really look at the tool and say, you know, that's something we hadn't thought about, and talk to their parents, talk to their loved ones, talk to their friends about how to really enhance care.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your experience with families. You work, I imagine, with so many different families under very different circumstances. Is there one circumstance or experience that stands out that you can share with us, and perhaps a family out there can relate to this particular experience and how you help them resolve it?
Sure. You know, I think today more than ever, many of us are dealing with friends, family members that are dealing with Alzheimer's. And the numbers are only growing, and it's not a matter of if we're going to be dealing with it, it's a matter of when we are. And I often work with families that are dealing with cognitive impairment like an Alzheimer's disease. I work to really educate them about what to expect, how they can advocate for their loved ones, what kind of tools they can use to improve quality of care, and strategies really for living well. Because oftentimes after getting a diagnosis, people are sent home, and it's like going into the Wild West. It's like not having a compass, and where do we start? That being said, let me give you an example. There was a family that I worked with, a lovely family who had a wonderful support system, but the children were out of state, and mom was diagnosed with the disease and very high functioning and very able. But what was happening was that she was not sleeping at night and oftentimes wandering and became confused in the evenings and would call her daughters. And needless to say, this concerned them, and they decided to get some support, and then I was brought in. And when I initially met with them, I went to the house to meet with the daughters, both came into town, and I met with mom. And what we realized was that oftentimes during the day, mom was sitting in front of a television and plopping herself there and most of the time falling asleep. She wasn't really engaged in anything that was meaningful. She wasn't involved in community events. She wasn't participating in anything that gave her purpose. So they originally thought, well, we really should talk to the doctor about getting her medicated at night so she can sleep better. And so what we really did was we talked about what were the issues at hand. And then what I suggested was that we look at enrolling her in an adult day program, one that had meaningful activities, outings to museums, social events, so that she could really have a sense of purpose. Then we hired a caregiver at night, and again, here was where I came in to help, because they really didn't know, how do you hire a caregiver? What's the difference between an agency and a registry, for-profit, non-for-profit? So I helped them through that process, and once we had a caregiver in place to work in the evenings, the daughters could go back home feeling rest assured that mom was being cared for and that someone was watching over her. But interestingly enough, by getting her involved in the adult day program and a place that had routine and activities, it ended up she was sleeping much better at night. She wasn't getting up. She wasn't wandering. And we were able to really put a good plan in place to be proactive rather than reactive. And we did this without having to resort to medication management.
Well, that's a great story. And you were talking about how you help the families, help them find a caregiver. You mentioned a couple of different criteria there. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's really interesting. And well, I know we get many questions on the website and in our social media pages about what's the best way and easiest way to go about doing that.
Well, it's interesting because what I find is that a lot of people will put more effort into hiring a cleaning lady or a dog walker than they will into hiring caregivers. And that's not because they don't care. It's oftentimes because they don't have the right information and that they're not armed with what to be asking. So part of what I do when I meet with a family or consult with them via phone is to really find out what their needs are and address questions so that when they interview people, they really have an understanding of what they're looking for, especially if they have a loved one who's dealing with a memory issue or somebody that's dealing with a chronic health condition that's in a state of fluctuation, like a congestive heart failure. It's really important to get a caregiver in who understands disease process but also has those soft skills and really understands the finesse of working with somebody with that disease, because no two people are the same. Going back to how to hire somebody, how to find them, in each state it's going to be a little different. In Illinois, we have new regulations so that caregiver agencies have to be licensed. But just because somebody is licensed, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person you're getting, the frontline worker, is well-trained. So there's a way to really do this and to look with a third eye and listen with a third ear when you're interviewing them. And I explain to families when they're looking for caregivers to consider non-for-profit organizations as opposed to just the for-profits. The criteria by which they hire and they train and they work with their caregivers is going to be very different. So it really is quite an involved process, and oftentimes, you know, families need to take a little bit of time to really think it through and have somebody help them in this process, because it's not always easy to find the right caregiver. You just don't want to put a person in place.
Right. And just out of curiosity, because this is, I think, the first time we're really talking about the differences of nonprofit versus for-profit agencies, what would you say would be maybe some of the top few things we should know about maybe some of those key differences?
In non-for-profit organizations, you have to remember their focus is oftentimes, many of the non-for-profits are religiously based organizations. So they have a mission towards serving the community at large, and they oftentimes will work on a sliding scale. They understand that families are on limited budgets, so they have scholarships. They have funds that are oftentimes set aside to help people because they're non-for-profit. And they tend to put a lot more emphasis on training and educating their caregivers on disease process, about confidentiality, about privacy, about understanding best practices, knowing really how to work with a client as a team member as opposed to somebody coming in and taking over. In for-profits, it's strictly a business. So there's a fee that's charged, and oftentimes while they have to get training, the organizations, again, depending on which state, will only train them based on what the minimum requirements are for the state. And in some states, that's not even anything. So it's really important when you talk to somebody to really ask difficult questions and to really get a sense of what their experience is like, not just if they've worked with somebody who has Alzheimer's or frontal temporal dementia or you know, congestive heart failure, but tell me a little bit about what you would do with that client. What are your best practices? What's your statement of mission when you work with a person that has that disease?
Right. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's very helpful. I'm sure many families out there are in the process of or thinking about that for the near future. So thank you for sharing that information. So you're really an advocate about helping families being better prepared and avoid a health crisis. I think many families, I'm sure you've seen, find themselves in sort of the crisis mode. And so what are your suggestions about helping them prepare to avoid a crisis?
Well, it's very important that people have an ongoing discussion and really talk about what's right for their family. I think in most cases what usually happens is, again, we will talk about certain subjects in our culture, but we really tend to put off the issues of aging, end of life, and really best practices in terms of how we want our care to be. So what I tell people, it's very important that they start getting things in order, but first start talking about what quality of life means to them. What do they want with, you know, for aging? What, in terms of purpose and in terms of joy, what brings that to, you know, to the table? How are they going to maintain that? What are their personal wishes for end of life? Have they talked about this with anybody? Oftentimes, it's a step-by-step process. This can't be done in one, you know, in one sitting.
Sure.
And
sure,
I think planning ahead is key in terms of, you know, putting emotions aside, but also looking at what, in terms of having quality of life, how do I prevent a crisis? How do I make sure emotionally and financially and legally we're prepared for this? You know, a lot of times people have information, but if you ask your friends, oftentimes they, or a spouse, a lot of people can't even tell you the blood type of their spouse or their children. And in an emergency, it's so important to be able to provide vital information. So ways to prevent it will be to get documents in order. Everybody should have, whether it's my personal health care passport or a folder, a document that allows them to put everything together in one place so they feel empowered and they don't have to be running all over. You know, I have many people that will say to me, Melissa, I have it on my computer, and I think that's great. However, in a 911 emergency, you're not going to have time to download that. And if you have it on a flash drive, that's great, but it may not be compatible with the emergency room. So it's important to have something that's practical, that you can look at, that you can bring with you. Again, whether it's my booklet or a folder, you want to have certain documents in order. Those documents, in order to prevent a crisis, key and first and foremost these days is a HIPAA form. HIPAA is the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, and this was really a document, a legal document, that was designed to protect our private information. Each one of us needs to get one authorized so that information can be released and shared. In other words, if I call my doctor and I'm in the hospital and I say, please make sure that you speak to my friends or my siblings, the only way they can do that is if I sign a HIPAA release form. So everybody needs to have a copy of that. They should always keep copies in their folder at home so they don't have to re-sign them all the time, so that if there's a new doctor or there's an emergency room visit or there's someplace else they're traveling to, they have that form with them. The other thing
Let me ask you about the HIPAA document, mm-hmm. Because a lot of people don't have that ready. Just out of curiosity, if there were an emergency, let's say, my mother is very ill and I have to take her to the emergency room, and let's say she's unconscious and I don't have a HIPAA document where she is designated as, where she's designated me as someone who can, speak or obtain information on her behalf. I mean, so what would happen in that instance?
Well, that's a really good question. And again, every, state is going to have different laws and mm-hmm. different institutions will govern things differently. What I can tell your listeners is the first thing they should do is to contact their primary doctors and ask the doctors to send them, or they could pick up a HIPAA form, a release of information form. They could also contact their hospital of choice. And I say hospital of choice because if they call 911, most likely they will be taken to the closest hospital available, not necessarily mm-hmm. the hospital where their doctors have privileges. So it's important to have the release for the hospital they want to go to and the hospital they may have to go to in advance. Each one of us can do this and put this in our folder. That way they have it on record, you have it on record. That being said, in an emergency, you're going to go there and they're going to talk to you, but they'll find out if these documents are in place, and hopefully they will try to address it in an emergent situation. But going forward, it's required that you have all those documents together. The other thing is, in an emergent situation, it's key that people have designated a healthcare proxy. And this is oftentimes referred to as a durable medical power of attorney. This is a legal document that enables us to make healthcare decisions for a loved one in the event that they're not able to make the decisions for themselves. The document must be prepared while the person is still mentally competent. So you want to make sure that when somebody is ill, that they're doing it very early on and they decide who they want to be their healthcare proxy. And in that discussion, it's also important to look at, is this person, the person you're picking, are they right for this position? Loved ones sometimes in an emergency, while they have the best of intentions, can't always act in our best interest. So it's important to look at who in your family or your friends or your circle will be best to be the person that would make important decisions. It doesn't mean that you don't love somebody else. It means that you're picking somebody that you know in an emergency or in a health crisis would be able to honor your wishes to the best of their ability without the emotional baggage that oftentimes comes with that.
Sure.
The other part of that, too, is that everybody should have a living will or an advanced directive. And these are documents that really outline what your wishes are in advance of a medical crisis. People could go into the hospital for a simple medical procedure and end up in, on a respirator, and somebody walks in and says, oh, no, she never wanted to be on a respirator. I know this. If this is irreversible, she would be upset that, she's on that. So it's important that everything is outlined. And besides having those documents, if people are not comfortable talking about it, this is where having somebody like myself, a care consultant or a care manager, come in to facilitate this with a family, because it's really a difficult discussion, and oftentimes it brings up family dynamics. And the key here is to make sure that we're honoring everybody's wishes and that the care plan is the same across the board and everybody's on the same page. But if those discussions don't happen in a process, oftentimes, disasters can happen. the other thing.
I'm still trying to convince my my own parents to fill these documents out, so
it's not an
easy discussion. It's very I think it brings up a lot of fear in, you know,
right. Exactly. That's key. I think not only fear, but I talk about the ostrich effect. I think if I bury my head, it won't happen. Well, what happens usually, you know, if people think it's hard to make those decisions and they have those conversations now, imagine what it's like in a crisis. I tell families that is the worst time, the absolute worst time to be making this important decisions and having a conversation about things you've never talked about. It brings up so many, you know, issues in terms of oftentimes fights and, you know, and people don't see things on the same page. So it's really important to do those in advance. And, those documents are not written in stone. A living will or an advance directive can't be changed. If you change your mind, you can change those documents. This is not something that is determining an acute situation. It's talking about if something were irreversible. There's a difference, and I think part of the fear for many people is really talking about, you know, they think if I had a heart attack and I'm unconscious for a while, my family's going to pull the plug. Well, that's an acute situation that chances are somebody is going to come out of. That's a very different picture than somebody who has been in a comatose state with brain damage and isn't going to recover. So it's important that people understand the difference between acute and irreversible. Where there's an irreversible situation, you know, if it's irreversible, then that's something that's acute. If it's reversible, that's an acute situation where they can take care of it. It doesn't mean that you're pulling the plug. If something is irreversible, what you're doing is putting wishes in place so that people can be better prepared and not have to make that decision then.
Right.
Hopefully I didn't confuse you just now.
No, absolutely. That was very clear. Just generally these conversations about, having them actually fill out the paper, you know, having these documents in place is not the easiest. So, you're right, it is a process, and it's not, it won't happen in one day, it won't happen at one sitting. It's, as you said, a process. So let's talk about the personal healthcare passport, Melissa, because you are an advocate for having documents in place for keeping things kind of in one place. Tell us about the passport. Is it a physical?
It's a very small book. It's 48 pages. Excuse me. That really what I did was I synthesized everything that people are going to need in terms of aging well, and have created an opportunity for them to document it. Excuse me. Hold on one moment. Not only to document their wishes, to chronicle their health history, but also to plan ahead and to look at if my needs change, what do I need to do to address that? Oftentimes, people have many different doctors they're going to, and records are in several places. This is a way to get everything together. So it's portable. I wanted people to feel empowered. I wanted them to understand that when they go from one doctor to another, that information should be shared. That if you're going to the eye doctor or the dentist, it's important to let them know you're on blood thinners. Because if you're on blood thinners and they need to do dental work, they may have to take you off those medications for 5 days so that you don't bleed during a procedure.
Right.
And so the tool is really meant to create a better dialogue with care providers and family members, but also as a way to make families aware of the things they should be tuned into. In the booklet, I've also given tips how to have a dialogue about things, what to do if you're traveling, how to prepare family members, how to manage medications. You know, oftentimes people will be on medications and then they're stopped. 6 months later, they're put on new ones, and the doctors may ask, well, what were you on previously? And they say, the pink one, the blue one, it's the one for the high blood pressure. Well, that information can be vital because if they've adjusted them, the adjustments may have been made because there were side effects that can impact new prescriptions. So I tell families, write down, document as much as you can. Once you have it completed, take this booklet with you. I have family members that take it when they travel, because when they travel overseas, for example, you know, your medical records aren't going to go necessarily electronically to another country. And when we travel, you know, our health insurance doesn't cover us overseas. Most people don't know that. So I say make sure you have vital information with you. Have the travel insurance. This booklet really kind of puts everything together for real life. Again, what I did for my mother, I consolidated it for families because I wanted them to be empowered. I didn't want to see anybody go through an unnecessary crisis.
Well, it's very smart. And where can people learn more about the Personal Healthcare Passport and perhaps more about you? Where your website, can you give us the website address?
Sure. It's www.khanhealthcare.com, and that's KHANHEALTHCARE.com, or they can follow me on Twitter at caregivertools at Khan Healthcare, or they can contact me via phone at 773-907-9788. The other
Great.
Thing, if I can add, Susan, too,
sure.
when we're talking about documents, now that we're in the electronic age, I think it's important that people also create an inventory of their electronic records. Many of us have things on computer, on iPhones, on iPads, and it's important to have a, if you will, a cheat sheet, like an inventory of where those accounts are, the name of the accounts, and passwords. Because, again, in case of a medical emergency, if somebody has to jump in and help out and you're only doing online banking, but they don't know how to get on your computer, it's important to have all this organized. And we are now in the electronic age where most of us have multiple accounts, multiple emails, and a lot of passwords. And somebody coming in to help out as a caregiver may not be aware of those. So I encourage families and individuals to create an inventory for their electronic records. And the other part of that, too, is you can sit down with an elder law attorney, review all your documents. You know, if you have a living will or you have wills or you have the healthcare proxy and you want to amend it or you want to make modifications, there are elder law attorneys who specialize in this and are really good at helping families to address it. Some states also even provide living wills and advance directives online so that families can download those for free. It's better to have one than not have one, but you have to check with your state and find out if it's considered a legal binding document in your state.
Well, Melissa, thank you very much. That is very good and very helpful advice. We are here at the end of our show. It's been really a great pleasure having you as our guest, and I want to repeat your website address again. It is khanhealthcare.com, khan, K-A-H-N, healthcare.com. Melissa, thank you again. I'd like to also thank our audience for tuning in. Thank you, and join us next Tuesday when Marjorie Papst will be interviewing a very special guest who is Gay Hanna, the executive director of the National Center for Creative Aging. It's an interdisciplinary nonprofit organization focusing on creative expression through the arts and humanities. So that will be a very exciting show. Thank you all again, and thank you, Melissa, and we look forward to having you back if you're available.
Would love that. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Thank you.